You can go.
Good morning.
I've
brought what purports to be a better sound system today. So, can you hear in the back? It's better than me shouting, I'm sure. Today, I want to talk about phase two and phase three of the conflict between Robert Hooke and Isaac Newton. Phase one ended more or less in 1675 with the last letter correspondence between Hooke and Newton. And today we will have perhaps more physics than any other day, which makes me happy if not anybody else. Phase two began about 1679. Henry Oldenburg had died 2 years before, and Robert Hooke had been appointed secretary of the society. There were several brief notes between the two men, even one from Newton to Hooke, congratulating him more or less on his accession to this important position. And he served in this position for 5 years. The second argument between the two men is not about light this time, but it is about gravity. And so and we need some background information. And I'm going to start with an Italian, Giovanni Alfonso Borelli, lovely Italian name, born in Naples in 1608, and he died in Rome in 1679, just about the time that the second round of the argument between these two English gentlemen was beginning. As with most people in his time, he published in a wide variety of fields: astronomy, mathematics, physiology, epidemiology, volcanology — he did, after all, come from Naples — and physics. He's primarily remembered for his contribution to celestial mechanics, and that's the area in which will be of interest to us. Hooke presented his first paper to the Royal Society way back in 1666, and it was about gravity, and it was deeply influenced by Borelli. Now, 1666 was the time Newton was watching the apple fall in his mother's garden and developing the correct mathematical theory of gravity. And we will actually talk about the apple, which Newton claimed is a true story. It didn't hit him on the head, by the way. Borelli, in turn, was deeply involved by Johannes Kepler. Kepler was a great believer in the heliocentric theory of the solar system, that is, the sun being at the center, and he was looking for ways in which the sun could influence the rotation of the rotations of the planets. And his idea was that the sun exerted some sort of rays. He didn't say exactly what kind of rays he meant, but most people think it was some sort of magnetism. And because the sun is rotating, and it does rotate about once every 11 days, because the sun rotates, it drags the planets along with these magical magnetic rays that come out. And Borelli said this, and he said that there was some kind of tendency or natural instinct for the sun to do this. Now, in modern terms, this natural instinct means that there's a constant force between the sun, and all of the planets. And of course, that's not true. And what Hooke did was to replace this natural tendency, this constant force, with the force which got weaker as you go farther out from the sun, which is in fact true. But Hooke does not show in any mathematical sense how this works. Newton, of course, was perfectly able to do that. Nonetheless, he's taken a big step, because Borelli's theory is incorrect. Hooke's theory is just incomplete. But the work of Hooke is of such importance that I want to quote at least the three major consequences thereof. First of all bodies have a gravitational attraction, so that the sun attracts the earth, but it also attracts Mars, the earth attracts Mars, Jupiter attracts the earth, every object in the solar system attracts the moon. All of these, any object with mass, including you and me, attract one another gravitationally. The gravitational force is, of course, very weak for things like us, but very strong for massive objects like the planets. That's the first part of what he says. Secondly, he makes a very important statement that he says that the natural direction of motion will be in a straight line. We saw yesterday that Aristotle already said that, and it takes a force to deflect an object from a straight line. In other words, the fact that the planets do not move in straight lines is due to the force of gravity. And the third thing he said, which I already mentioned, is that the gravitational force varies with distance. Now, he has written a very long letter, or a long paper, and when he finds out that Newton lays claim to a very similar thing, he's going to claim, and I can understand why, Newton may have plagiarized or copied from him, although Newton had done this many years in advance. Now, in his role as secretary, he wrote a letter to Newton on the 24th of November in 1679, a letter he describes as his present scribble, and he says that he would like to have a correspondence with Newton about the motions of planets, but that this is just confidential between you and me, he says. Now, in this letter, he asks Newton, he says, please do communicate by letter your objections against any hypothesis or opinion of mine, and particularly if you will let me know your thoughts of that of compounding celestial motions of the planets, of a direct motion by the tangent and an attractive motion towards the central body. And what he's saying is that objects tend to move in straight lines. This is Newton's first law, as we shall see in a bit. And the force of gravity deflects them from their straight line motion. So he's looking for objections to these ideas. Now, scholars have worried about why in the world he would bother to write Newton, and one of the greatest of such scholars, the Frenchman Alexandre Coiré, thinks that he's just trying to sort of needle Newton a little bit and see if he can't raise some, provoke some reaction from the man. Whatever his motives in writing, Newton replied very angrily, so angrily that he angered Hooke in return, and Hooke then immediately broke his promise and read the letter out to the Royal Society in public. And this is very crucial, because in that letter, Isaac Newton made one of the very few public errors he ever made. And a man of his psychological nature did not brook error very easily. Now, we, all of us here, are what Newton would have called in this era before political correctness, ye vulgar. And so I will try to explain. It took me a while to understand it, so maybe I can get this across. The problem involves the diurnal motion of the Earth, that is the daily rotation of the Earth, which is from west to east, which is, of course, why we see the sun rise in the east and so forth. The explanation that we're looking for involves the idea of inertia. And this is inertia comes from the Latin word meaning an idleness or a lack of ability. Now, Galileo had already discussed the idea of inertia, and he discussed it in the following example. Imagine a ship moving through very calm water so that you can't, it doesn't rock or bounce or anything like that. At the top of the mast is a sailor carrying a penknife, and the sailor drops a penknife. Where does it fall? Now, according to Aristotle, motion occurs of natural motion and impelled motion. And the only impelled motion is down, and so it will fall down. And because the ship is moving, it will fall behind the mast. Now, of course, we know that's not true. Okay? It falls right at the bottom of the mast. So that to the sailor who drops it, it appears to fall in a straight line. To us watching from Earth, it appears to move horizontally and vertically, and its path would actually be that of a parabola if we could trace out its path moment by moment. Now, the horizontal motion of that ship in no way changes the vertical motion, because the sailor, the penknife, the ship, etc., are all moving horizontally, and because of the principle of inertia, that horizontal motion stays with the penknife even as it's falling. Now, let's attach this the same problem to the rotation of the Earth. And the difference here is that the ship is moving in a straight line at constant speed. The Earth is rotating. And that's a different story, and Newton knew it, because an object which is rotating, which is changing direction, is undergoing an acceleration, and this matters. So let us now imagine a very high, quite rigid pole attached to the Earth, and there's a person on top who's going to drop an object. Now the Earth and the pole are rotating, right, from west to east, if that's whatever. They're rotating. Now, because the pole is high, the person at the top of the pole is rotating faster than the person at the bottom of the pole. I hope that's obvious. This is like children playing the game of crack the whip. If the person, the child farthest from the center of the circle, has to run like the Dickens to keep up. Okay, so this person is moving faster here than at the bottom of the pole. Now when he drops the penknife, this penknife, of course, continues with that high velocity, faster than the bottom of the pole, and so it's going to land in front, not at the base, certainly not behind, as Aristotle would say, not at the base, as it would if it were moving at constant speed, but in fact to the east of the pole, in front. And Newton knew this, and he wrote this to Hooke. And he's wrong. And that's very upsetting. Because he's not much wrong, he's just a little bit wrong. Because his argument is absolutely correct if you're on the equator. But of course England is 51 degrees approximately, or London is 51 degrees north of the equator, and an object falling like that will not only fall to the east, but ever so slightly to the south. And Hooke knew it. And Newton should have known it, and he did know it, but he made a mistake. We who are some 35 degrees to the south, an object would land ever so slightly to the north of east. Now, Newton is aware of the rotation of the Earth. He's aware of what we would call the centrifugal force. And he's concerned, as people are in his day, about why we aren't spun off from the Earth. But since he can calculate the strength of the gravitational force, he knows that the strength of gravity, he compares the strength of gravity mathematically to the amount of the centrifugal force, and shows it's about 12 times bigger, which is why we aren't spun off, even if we are at the equator where we're going fast. However, he also points out very cleverly that because of the centrifugal force acting on the spinning Earth, the Earth's diameter at the equator should be bigger than the Earth's diameter at the poles. The Earth is squashed like this because of its rotation. This shape is called an oblate sphere. And the Earth is an oblate sphere. There was huge argument about this at Newton's time. And eventually, by measuring the size of degrees of latitude near the equator and then in high northerly latitudes, it was found indeed that they were not the same, and therefore the Earth is squashed, and Newton, of course, is correct. Now, Hooke points out that it falls slightly to the south, and he says it will fall in an elliptical path. Newton, who is... he writes this in a relatively friendly manner. I doubt that it's meant to be friendly. Because what we are faced with here is a battle of seriously narcissistic personalities. And there's not much friendship and certainly no peace between them. Newton, of course, as perhaps the more damaged of the two, was incredibly narcissistic. And like Narcissus, he could at many times see only his own reflection. His own reflection in this case being his work and his great ideas about how motion occurs. And so he is continually throughout his life threatening to withhold information and not publish it so that only he knows how God's universe is working. And of course, first he's upset that he made an error, but he's really furious that the error is pointed out by the man he hates more than anybody, Robert Hooke. And of course, as I said, Hooke read this letter in public out loud. So Newton thinks about this and he says, yes, you're right. It does fall slightly to the south, but you're absolutely wrong. It's not an elliptoid. Here's the shape of the curve, and he draws some wiggle. And he then adds, and of course, I can calculate it, meaning that you can't. But he's not right there either, actually. That curve's not correct either. And a few years later, he can, in fact, do the problem correctly. A month after that, Hooke wrote yet another correction to Newton and discussing experiments that he had done, both indoors and outdoors, to see if he couldn't measure this effect. Because Hooke was a very clever experimenter and a deeply intuitive thinker. But what he does in letters early in 1680 is he mentions two things that are going to prove to be terribly important. First of all, he mentions the name Edmund Halley to Newton. Halley was a young astronomer, a very, very brilliant young astronomer. And Halley was the first person to realize that in order to do star maps properly, you needed to go to the southern hemisphere. And since he had a wealthy father, his father gave him a bunch of money and some introductory letters to Charles, King Charles. And so off he went to St. Helena. Now, and then he mapped many of the stars. But in particular, Hooke mentions a problem because that Halley had found. St. Helena, as I didn't know, but probably everybody in South Africa knows, is a very volcanic island. And when I looked it up, it has a volcano that is 818 meters high. And so Halley climbed up this volcano to try to see the stars better at night. And he had a clock, because it's important if you are measuring the star positions in the heavens to know what time, obviously, as they change. And his clock, of course, was a pendulum clock. And lo and behold, as he went up the mountain, the period of the clock changed. It changed its timekeeping. Now, every beginning physics student knows that this is true, because the period of a pendulum depends on only two things. It depends on the length of the pendulum, and it depends on the acceleration due to the force of gravity. And the farther you go from the center of the Earth, the weaker gravity gets. And so, of course, the period of the pendulum changed. Halley didn't know this. Nobody knew that. Well, actually, Hooke probably knew it. Halley didn't know it. And he wrote reported this to the Royal Society. And Halley, as secretary, wrote this to Newton. The second thing that he did is he wrote to Newton about his ideas of gravity yet again. And I'm trying to find, he says that the force of gravity should be in duplicate distance to the distances reciprocally taken, whatever that means. I mean, it's very complicated language. But what he's talking about is what is known in physics as an inverse square force. And that is the way the force of gravity, and actually the force of electricity, both work. An inverse square law, or force law, means that the distance appears in the denominator of a fraction. So the bigger you make the distance, the weaker it becomes. The bigger you put a number in the denominator, the smaller the fraction. You know, tenth is bigger than a millionth. But it depends not on the distance, but on the square of the distance. So that if you double the distance, and you've got a square, that's a factor of four, and so you've got now a four in the denominator, so the force is a quarter of the size. Everybody follow that, I'm sure. Anyway, that's the so-called inverse square law, and that's how it works. That's the way nature is. And he knows that, and he says that, and then he says to Newton, and I'm sure with your mathematical ability, you can, in fact, calculate that. But he also says, in fact, Newton knew, could in fact calculate that, and had already done so. But he also says, not only will Newton discover the mathematical shape of this force, but he will find the physical reason for the force. And this is crucial. This is absolutely important, because Newton was unable to do that. In fact, nobody is able to do that, although Einstein may have been able to do that. It's a very difficult thing. Newton showed how gravity worked, but not why gravity worked. And that's a fundamental difference, because what he is doing is he's freeing physics from metaphysics. He's freeing physics from looking at causes of things and only to the description of things. And that's what science does. It describes how nature works. It doesn't say nature works because God created it, or it's an accident, or there was a big bang, or whatever. This is how nature works, but not why nature works. And this led to the great scientific achievements of the 18th and 19th century. It's huge. But it comes back to haunt Newton when we talk about his relationships with Leibniz on Thursday. Now, in late 1679, early 1680, Newton was very tender and very sensitive. Again, Freud tells us that great creativity often follows great loss. And 6 months before the interchange between Newton and Hooke, Newton's mother, Hannah, died. He relayed late in life that she had a son, Benjamin Smith, Newton's half-brother. He had an infection and a fever. She had gone to take care of him, caught the infection, and died from it. Newton, while she was ill, went back to Lincolnshire and nursed her, what he says very tenderly. Whether that's true or not, we don't know. But he's because of this nursing of her illness, and because of after she died having to straighten out her estate, he spent a fairly long time in Lincolnshire. This is 1679, the longest since he had been there in 1666. However, during the 13 years from 66 to 79, when he in 66 he returned to Cambridge, he reportedly only went back to Lincolnshire to visit his mother three times for short visits. And it has been noted by one of his biographers, in a quote I like a lot, more vigorous displays of filial affection have indeed been recorded. Following this bitter exchange with Hooke, Newton retires. He just withdraws. This is his standard technique. And he doesn't do anything from about 1680 until 1684, with rare exception. And what he worked on, because he was always working, were primarily theology problems and chronology problems. As we shall see Friday, Newton was terribly interested in ancient events and spent a huge amount of time trying to date Homer, Plato, Aristotle, various people throughout history, including, as we shall see, several completely mythological events like the voyage of Jason and the Argonauts. One thing, however, there were a couple of things that evinced his great interest. In November of 1680, a very bright comet appeared. And then it disappeared later in November. And then a second comet reappeared, going in the opposite direction, in mid-December. This, of course, was the same comet, but nobody believed that at the time because comets were, at that time, thought to be objects that were completely independent of natural forces. They were alien visitors somehow, and they didn't obey any of the laws that other objects obeyed, and they only went in straight lines. But the John Flamsteed, who was then the Astronomer Royal, thought that in fact, and correctly, that the comet had gone behind the sun, been attracted by the sun, turned around, and gone in the opposite direction, which is of course true. This bright comet has a period of 575 years, meaning its next appearance, when I calculated, will be in 2225, some 244 years from now, so I shan't hang around to see it. But Newton observed, made some observations. He even ground some new lenses, new mirrors rather, to make telescopes to see this, although apparently he never built a telescope. Then in 1682, a second comet appeared. And this comet, of course, is known as Halley's Comet, and that has come back. I saw it just a few, several years ago. And we will talk considerably more about Mr. Halley. Now, Newton's fame was gradually spreading, and people kept writing to him and annoying him in Cambridge. And so he hired a secretary, an amanuensis, whose name was Humphrey Newton, who also came from Lincolnshire, who also went to the Grantham Grammar School, and who was no relation whatsoever to Isaac. But this allowed him to correspond with people and to write and so forth, and that happened a lot. And then, in January of 1684, a discussion took place in a coffee house in London. Probably in a coffee house. It may have been at the Royal Society. Coffee, of course, had recently been imported to Europe. Caffeine is a very addictive drug. People liked it a lot. Coffee houses opened up. It wasn't Starbucks at the time, but there were lots of them. And people spent a long time, and they became places for deep intellectual discussion. This meeting occurred between Sir Christopher Wren, Robert Hooke, and Edmund Halley. And they were arguing about or wondering about the force of gravity. Now, everybody knew that it was an inverse square law. Everybody guessed that it was an inverse square law. Nobody could demonstrate it. And Hooke said, oh, but I can, except I'm keeping it secret until everybody really appreciates how seriously important it is. Hooke was not only a liar, but he was a terrible braggart. Wren knew it and knew that he couldn't do this. Since they had worked together in as architects after the Great Fire, Christopher Wren knew him very well. So what he did is he offered as a reward to anybody who could actually demonstrate this, he offered a valuable book. I think it was worth 2 or 2.5 pounds, which was a lot of money in those days. To anybody who could prove this within 2 months. Well, nobody could prove it within 2 months, and Halley waited about 7 months, and then he journeyed up to Cambridge and went to see that renowned mathematician, Isaac Newton, later Sir Isaac. And he asked him, what would be the curve that would be described by the planets, supposing that the force of attraction towards the sun to be reciprocal to the I haven't showed you my picture of Edmund Halley, which I wanted to do, dark as it is, but it was the best I could get from the web. And this is what Isaac, what he wrote later. It would be an ellipsis. Now, Halley was an astronomer. He knew Kepler's laws. Kepler's first law is that the planets move in elliptical orbits about the sun, with the sun at one focus. Circles, as we know, have a center, and you can take a string and put a nail in a board, put a string, put a pencil on the end, keep the string taut, and draw a circle with it. If you take two nails and you put a string, a loose string between them, and you put a pencil so that you keep both sides of the string always taut, you will draw an ellipse. And those two nails are called the foci. And that's Kepler's first law. And so he knew that that was the orbit of the planets. And when Newton tells him, well, I calculated this. And he said, wow, I want to see the calculation. And Newton replied, well, two problems. First of all, I'm not sure it's right, because I was able also to use, again, one of Kepler's laws, to relate the distance to the moon and the period of the moon's rotation, which we all know to be 27.3 days. And using this inverse square law, any undergraduate physics student can make a very simple calculation relating the time of the moon's orbit to the distance to the moon. It's very easy, 300 years after Newton. And when Newton plugged in the distance to the moon, he got the wrong answer. Okay? The two sides of the equation didn't equal. And so he said, well, that's a problem. And Halley said, oh, well, what distance did you use to the moon? And he tells him, and Halley said, oh, but you've got the wrong distance. And putting in the right distance, of course, it works perfectly. And so he asked Newton for his calculation. And Newton looks through his papers and he said, oh, I can't find it. I can't find it. I'll find it and send it to you. Now, I don't think there was a chance in hell that Newton would trust a stranger like this suspicious man that he was with so valuable a calculation. And so he promises to send this, and he does. But he doesn't send a simple calculation. But by November, this is from September to November, he sends a book. And this book, in its Latin title, is called De Moto Corporum in Gyrum, or On the Motions of Bodies in an Orbit. And in this, Newton derives all three of Kepler's laws and shows, moreover, hints at an even more a complete system of the theories of motion and things. Now, Halley was a smart guy. He realized how important this was. He hied himself directly back. He did not wait 7 months. He ran right back to Cambridge and confronted Newton. And then, as he reported in December, Newton promised to send his results to the society to be entered upon their register. Two other people entered Newton's life in 1684, who will play an important role. One was David Gregory, a Scottish mathematician, the nephew of James Gregory, who is one of the great mathematicians of the 17th century, who by this time was dead. And the other person is John Flamsteed, who I just talked about in terms of the comets. And Flamsteed, as we shall see, is about to supply Newton with astronomical data, which will be very important. By the end of 1684, since Halley has asked Newton to write a complete record of what he has been thinking, Newton enters a period of the most intense concentration, perhaps, of his life. And between 1684 and the middle of 1686, he produced his great masterpiece, the Principia Naturalis, the Philosophia Naturalis Principia Mathematica, the Principia. This is the most remarkable and the most revolutionary book in the history of physics, and probably in the history of science. Because in it, Newton creates the entire structure of motion and the theory of gravity and how the universe works. It is truly a remarkable, revolutionary work. Galileo had created what is called kinematics, how things move. But Newton not only explicated that very carefully, but also created the study of the forces that make things move, which we call dynamics, from the Greek word for force or energy. Things move for two reasons. First, they move because that's what they do. Objects, according to Newton's first law, that have mass, have inertia. Inertia, again, comes from this Latin word meaning an idleness or a lack of skill. The natural order of things is to move in straight lines at constant speed forever. And that's what Newton tells us, that any object in his first law, any object moving in a straight line at constant speed will continue to do so forever unless a force acts upon it. Now, when we see in our normal world, we see objects stopping all the time. I push back and it stops. And it stops because, of course, there is a force acting on it. The force is called friction. Okay. Now, we in our modern era who have this idea of spacecraft that go out and continue past the planets, and at least Voyager has left the solar system, we can imagine a system where there are no forces, basically, and objects will just continue in straight lines forever and ever. But then not in Newton's time. And his second law is even more important, because it says that if a change in this natural state of motion, that is a change either in the speed of an object or in the direction of an object, or both, these are called accelerations, that accelerations require forces. And forces exist in nature. And it is the job of a scientist to determine not only the existence of these forces, but the mathematical nature of these forces. And then once you have the mathematical nature of the force, you divide that force by the mass of the object, and that gives you its acceleration. This is the simple formula F equals ma in physics, probably the most profound combination of four symbols in all of science. Newton, of course, went out and found the nature of one force. He found the nature of the gravitational force, which varies inversely with the square of the distance, say, from the sun or from the center of whatever object we are talking about. To do this, he invented a term and a concept called the centripetal acceleration. That is the acceleration of gravity pulling the Earth toward the sun. Christian Huygens had already invented and used the term centrifugal acceleration. That is the throwing off of an object when you're being spun in a circle. And what Newton's, this familiar force to us, Newton tells us is incorrect. There is no such thing in reality as a centrifugal acceleration. And I can give you what I think is a simple example thereof. All of us have driven in cars, and let's suppose you're a passenger sitting in this country, or in Britain, on the left-hand side in the front by the door. And the car makes a sharp turn to the right, and you feel yourself thrown out against the left-hand side door. And you say, centrifugal force, centrifugal acceleration pushes me out. Incorrect. Bad reasoning. And the bad reasoning is you yourself are in an accelerated reference frame. The car is turning. It's going in a circle. It's an accelerated system. What's really happening to an observer looking at you from outside, say hovering in a helicopter, is because you're moving in a straight line, you keep moving in a straight line, the car door comes over because the car is turning, because the wheels are being pulled by the force of gravity against the tires, the car door comes and pushes your left shoulder. And that's what's really happening. You inside the car, all you know is there's a collision between your left shoulder and the left door. But the reason for that collision is different depending on whether you are in an accelerated system, and that's wrong, or whether you are outside and looking at it from above. This is all sorts of stuff that Newton has done. Now, Halley then writes a letter to Newton, telling him in May of 1686 of the decision of the Royal Society to publish the Principia. But he adds this one very pregnant sentence, that Mr. Hooke has some pretensions upon the invention of Gould. And he says, you had it from him. This is the first time, not the only time, Newton will be accused of plagiary. And he is never plagiarized, but it's always due to this retentiveness of his personality, his inability to publish results when he gets them. After all, he did this work in 1666. It's now 1686, I mean, 20 years later. Newton replies in fury. He says, lots of people knew how gravity worked. They understood that this was the force, but nobody could prove it except me, and Hooke is a liar. And in a 3-page postscript to this letter, P.S., 3 pages long, he writes that Hooke is plagiarized from him, and he has done nothing, excusing himself by reason of his other business ways. He should have said, he can't do it. Now, poor Robert Hooke, who was a great intuitive thinker and a marvelous inventor, had a hard time with lots of people. Here is a comment from Christian Huygens to his father, way back in 1665. He understands no geometry at all. Huygens was a very great mathematician. I have also somewhere here a picture of Christian Huygens, who died about less than 10 years after the Principia appeared. Now, Newton is so furious at this point that he writes to Halley that he's going to withhold the last book of the Principia, and you can publish what you've got, but I'm not giving you the rest. Halley, of course, being a very good man, fires back an answer full of soothing words and pours lots of oil on troubled waters. And Newton says, oh, well, if you really want it, I'll give you the last book. And he did so. He even went so far in the Principia to write the comment, as our countrymen, when he writes about gravity, as our countrymen Wren, Halley, and Hooke have also severally concluded. This is the only mention of Hooke in the Principia at all. And good old Halley, who is a very diplomatic man, changed the order of the names and put himself last. He was the youngest, and he knew what he was doing. Newton had a hard time letting this drop, and he went back and again wrote to him that he found letters that he had written to Oldenburg back in 1673. That's now 13 years late earlier, and he writes to Halley, in short, as these things compared together show, I was before Mr. Hooke in what he pretends to have been my master. So I learned nothing by his letter, but that bodies fall not only to ye east, but also in our latitude to ye south. But eventually Hooke's diplomacy worked, and Newton let the matter drop. But it was because of this argument, this final argument of phases 2 and 3 with this plagiary claim of Hooke's, that Newton refused ever to have anything to do with the Royal Society again. From 1687 until Hooke died in 1703, Newton never attended a meeting or never communicated and had nothing to do with the Royal Society. After Hooke's death, he went back in 1704, and as we've seen, and then we'll see again, became the president of that. I disparage Hooke a lot, but he was a great inventor and a great intuitive genius, and he just wasn't Newton. He wasn't a very good mathematician, and he wasn't certainly Newton's equal in any way. Nonetheless, he was a very great man, and he deserves a considerable amount of respect. But the scientific difference between him and Newton was immense. And there is an interesting quote by Alexis Clairaut, a mathematician from the 17th and 18th century, of the distance between a truth glimpsed and a truth demonstrated. Clairaut, and I put him in because he's one of the first people to measure these degrees of latitude to show the difference of the oblateness of the Earth. So Robert Hooke understood there was a law of gravity, and he even understood it had a mathematical nature, but Newton created a new system of the universe. I mean, there's a huge difference between them. This masterpiece, which is now in print, permission for printing. Oh, before that, I want to show you that Halley, in 1687, he got himself. He was a clerk in the Royal Society. He got himself the position of editor of the Principia, which was very important. But unfortunately, as editor, he also had to pay for it, the printing and the distribution thereof. Fortunately, this book is a bestseller, and he made considerable amount of money. 9 shillings. The book was printed, and here is a copy of the first page. And I don't know if you can notice, but there is the name of the president of the Royal Society, one Samuel Pepys, giving permission. This book is monumental, it's mathematical, it's profound, and it's obscure. Only those people with considerable mathematical ability could hope possibly to read it. John Locke, who certainly was a friend of Isaac Newton, and had his own copy of the Principia, could only read the descriptive parts, and he did that because he asked Christian Huygens if he could trust the mathematics, and Huygens said, "It's okay, you can trust that," and so he just read what he could read. One supposed reason for making it so mathematically difficult and obscure was, of course, to make it hard for Hooke to understand. That's not my opinion, it's the opinion of respectable historians. But again, what this book did not do was explain how it was the Earth could feel a force from the sun some 150 million kilometers away. What Newton was able to do was to demonstrate that this force could not be what I called yesterday a mechanical force. It could not be a force of touching, of contact. But how does the Earth know the sun is out there? How does the moon know the Earth is out here? How does gravity work? He was never able to answer that, ever. And this is going to lead to grave problems of him with Leibniz. But first, what I'd like to do is to turn our attention to John Flamsteed, the astronomer royal, then installed at his observatory in Greenwich, and the second, and probably the least, of Newton's great enemies. We'll do that tomorrow. This is a really short time for me, 47 minutes according to my watch, so there's plenty of time for questions if you have. And then you don't have time or too embarrassed to ask questions, I go sit outside usually and have a coffee afterwards, and I'm happy to talk about this stuff forever. Yes, sir.
It's a very stupid question.
No. Not true. that adjective never goes with the word question.
What makes the Earth rotate? I understand it going around the around the sun, but what makes it
go around that 24 hours? I'll start. I mean, the sun came about because gases collapsed. The sun rotates, so you could ask the same question, why the sun rotates. And the sun rotates because as these gases collapse, they don't always fall directly into the center. So if you have a ball of gas, some gas will fall like that because it's moving so fast it doesn't have time to go. But and so when it gets captured by the gravity of what's already there, it gives it a little push this way. And so
if in the same way, if you've got gas coming from here and gas coming from here, it causes this object to rotate. And that's also what happened with the Earth. Whether the Earth, I won't posture where the Earth comes from.
But why is it so exact after so many years? Why does it rotate in exactly 23 hours, X number of minutes?
What's because any object that is in motion will continue in motion unless there's a force causing it to slow down. Once it starts, it goes forever. Now there is a force causing the Earth to slow down. It's the gravitational attraction of the Moon. And so the Moon is getting a little bit closer to the Earth, and the Earth is slowing a little bit. Also, there is some friction on the Earth. You just go out and look at the Atlantic Ocean, and every time the tide comes in and it rubs against the bottom of the ocean, that's a friction force, and that slows a little bit of the rotation of the Earth. And I don't know offhand how much we're slowing, but it's not much. I mean, it's not my particular weather. Yes, sir.
If the shape of the Earth is an object sphere, and gravity being subject to the inverse square law, does that mean we weigh less at the equator than we would?
Oh, absolutely! Indubitably, you weigh less at the equator. Indeed.
And if we want to go down the gold mine.
I'm sorry?
And if it's normal to go down the gold mine, it's not the equator.
Well, if you've done it, that's a tricky point. That's tricky because the force of gravity changes its nature once you're inside the Earth and when you're outside the Earth. And so the force of gravity decreases as you go towards the center of the Earth. And that's a wonderful problem that I used to love to get to beginning physics students to compare the gravitational force in a tunnel with the gravitational force outside the Earth. In fact, if you were to drill a tunnel, you could drill a tunnel completely through the Earth all the way to the other side and jump in that tunnel, you would oscillate back and forth. And the period of oscillation would be about 90 minutes, which is the same time that satellites take in Earth's orbit to go up. It's the same doing that. Yes, sir.
You mentioned that there was, I think the satellite was called, the probe was called Pioneer.
Yes, Voyager 1.
Voyager. And that it has now left the solar system, and that will continue indefinitely. Surely there are gravitational forces.
Oh, unquestionably.
You did not mean indefinitely.
No, I don't mean indefinitely a straight line. I'm ignoring the fact that there's any gravity. It's pretty weak, but of course it exists. And every time it went anywhere near a planet, it didn't go straight. Can people hear the question?
Yes.
Yeah.
So is gravity a function of the...
I'm the one with a difficult argument.
Of the electromagnetic force?
Oh, no. It has nothing to do with electromagnetic force. Poor Albert Einstein spent a great fraction of his life trying to find a relationship between gravity and electromagnetism, and he was unable to do so. There is a very seductive idea. If you look at Newton's law of gravity, it varies inversely as the square of the distance from the center of the Earth or the Sun or whatever. If you have a charged object and another charged object, and you look at the electrical force between them, it also varies inversely as the square of the distance between them. That's called Coulomb's law. And if you look at that, and I remember looking at it as a kid, boy, there must be something in there, some relationship. And Einstein, thought also, and was looking for a unified force to put together electromagnetism and gravity. And to this day, no one has been able to do it. It's not a problem that has been solved yet. Of all the forces, and in normal nature, there are two forces that we have. We have gravity, and we have electricity and magnetism, which produce and stuff. And so those are the forces that control our world. But in reality, there are two other forces. They're called the weak force, which is responsible for radioactive decay. And there is the strong force, which is responsible for us. That is, it makes the nuclei of atoms about which we couldn't get. Now, 30-some years ago, it was found that you could combine this radioactive force, the weak force, with electricity, with electromagnetic force. So they're really variants of the same thing. And it looks pretty much as if there are many theories in which purported to put the strong force, which is responsible for nuclei, together with these other two. However, nobody has succeeded yet in a decent theory that I know of, that is, or in fact, I'm sure, there's no experimental verification of any of these fancy M theories or supersymmetry theories or anything of this kind of physics that purport to perhaps to be able to put gravity together. There's no evidence whatsoever. So, as far as I know, that's just not possible. So it's still a puzzle. It leaves something for the young generation to do in order to solve all the problems. I'm sorry.
One more question, and then...
We wondered if you were going to deal with...
I beg your pardon, sir. It's my fault because I'm sort of 90% deaf.
I wondered if you were going to deal with Newton's interest in alchemy.
Oh, yes.
We'll be dealing with...
A little bit. He was very serious about alchemy. And as I will point out, alchemy for him had nothing to do with turning red into blue. It had to do with finding out how God made the universe. Newton was a deep religious person.
Would you indicate this?
Newton? Yeah, he was more religious than anybody I've ever met. But he was a heretic. He wasn't an atheist at all. But he was a heretic. But I'll see you then. I promise.